good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding in the dark.
You're listening to episode 528 of Unwelcome Guests. I'm Robin Upton. This week's show is about the Bilderberg Group, or the Bilderberg Meeting, or the Bilderberg Club, according to Wikipedia. I'm always suspicious about organizations that try and have three names when one would do. Whatever you call it, it's a group of business, political, and financial leaders who meet up every year and have done for just over 50 years. And that's about where the official story ends. Until recently, there was no official story at all. They didn't officially exist. Which hasn't made it an easy show to create, because I try and use the most reputable sources possible, but almost nobody was going to go on the record and talk about the Bilderberg Group. So let's start gently. This is from a book called Secrets and Lies, and we'll get you started on who the Bilderberg Group are.
If you ignore the wild conspiracy theories that go hand in hand with most mentions of the Bilderberg Group, and concentrate on the facts, the true picture is of a collection of the richest and most powerful people on the planet who meet up once a year. Given the type of coverage that a gathering like the annual World Economic Forum meetings at Davos in Switzerland generates, you would expect that a gathering of world leaders, fast-rising politicians, key military thinkers, press barons, and the richest and most influential business figures on the planet would attract a few journalists. When the 2004 Bilderberg meeting in Italy drew Prime Minister Tony Blair, President George W. Bush, and Melinda Gates, wife of Bill Gates, you would think there would be a press stampede. In fact, there was almost a media blackout of the event. The few papers that mentioned it was due to happen did not send reporting teams to cover it. No major national or international news network attempted to film it. When people who usually draw journalists to them like moths to a flame can avoid publicity like that, it's fair to say that the Bilderberg Group is as secret as such an impressive collection of the world's rich and mighty can ever get. Why is such an important meeting underreported? In the 1990s, William Glasgow at Business Week suggested the reason was simply cost-cutting. After all, we can't afford to cover everything. But a journalist at The Economist, one of the UK's most important magazines, gave an alternative explanation. The Bilderbergers have been removed from our assignment list by executive order. Whilst policies may have changed, business magazines are still lacking the in-depth coverage that most readers would expect a Bilderberg gathering worthy of generating. Of course, there's another reason why journalists don't try to cover the Bilderberg Group meetings. In 1998, one plucky and independent-minded Scottish reporter tried to cover the Bilderberg Group meeting at the Turnberry Hotel in Ayrshire. For the crime of doing nothing more than asking questions, he was handcuffed by the Strathclyde police like a violent criminal and thrown into jail.
Thanks to Malcolm Greaves for that reading. That was on Dialect Radio, which is a local radio station in Bristol, England, but one which uploads its programmes to radioforall.net. So if ever you feel like listening in, then of course you can do that globally. And the guy who posted that, Tony Gosling, is one of the preeminent watchers of the Bilderberg Group. And in fact, he was how I heard of the group, through his website, bilderberg.org. And now we're going to have a conversation of his with George Butler and Charlotte Littlefield. This is from 29th of May this year. I've edited it slightly in order to preserve the continuity, because it's mainly Tony Gosling who has useful information. But as always, if you want to download the original audio, that will be linked in from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net. /528. He's talking about this year's Bilderberg 2010, which by far and away was the most publicised Bilderberg. This is owing a lot of thanks to Charlie Skelton in 2009, who went to the Greek meeting and was basically roughed up by the police and wrote about it, and the Guardian editors let that pass. So the fallout has been that for so long off-limits for commercial newspapers, the Bilderberg meeting now is being reported on. So here is Tony Gosling from earlier this year.
It's very exciting, this Bilderberg this year, isn't it? First of all, that we've had quite a lot of what looked like genuine leaks. You know, the thing is with leaks is always, I mean, ever since I first started doing this, you get leaks before the Bilderberg conference of lists of names and addresses. Some of them are completely bogus, others are slightly bogus, but the one we've had this year, I trust you've seen it.
Have you seen
the leaked list this year? It came out.
Yeah, I've seen some of those coming out of American Free Press, Jim Tucker.
Good, yeah. Well, there's several people that seem to have got hold of the list this year. And I've had a good look through it this evening, and it does definitely look like a, you know, well, not definitely, but it looks like a genuine list. And this is pretty much, as far as I can remember, unprecedented. Normally the lists don't get leaked beforehand, the genuine ones. It's literally the last day of the conference on the Sunday. So I think, you know, this to me rings some very good alarm bells, not alarm bells, but good, because I think that there are a lot of people in the sort of diplomatic and intelligence world that have seen these over the years and have access to them and have not leaked them. Now, last year, the Greek meeting was leaked incredibly by actually someone at the Dutch embassy, I think in New York. And we're starting to see people in the diplomatic service not now thinking that Bilderberg is too powerful, but actually starting to think, well, actually the public's got a right to know this. And so I think that the balance is tipping slightly away from them being intimidated by the Bilderbergers. Looking through this list here, I always sort of pick out a few names. The one name, of course, that's not there, which is always, I don't know if you're a bit obsessed like I am with these lists, clicking through them and saying, well, who is this guy and who is this person? I mean, we've got the kings and queens, the normal, you know, royalty there. But the one person that's not on the list, who I would suggest is going to be at the meeting, but will be brought in a car with blacked out windows, is Kenneth Clark, the new Lord Chancellor here in Britain. He's a tobacco industry executive who was health minister, etc., as you would expect, of course, under Margaret Thatcher back in the 1980s. And he's just been made, literally 2 weeks ago, the Secretary of State for Justice. I mean, this is chilling stuff to have this guy put into these positions, and also Lord Chancellor. Now, historically in Britain, I'm not all that familiar with the American political system, but in Britain, the Lord Chancellor is known as really one of the most powerful people in the country, because he has one foot in the camp of the legislature, you know, the lawmakers, and the other camp in the judiciary. And he's really the only senior figure, you know, and he's around the cabinet table too. So he's a very, very powerful chap. He's also very good at spinning himself, you know, and this is one of the things characteristic of these Bilderbergers, as a kind of innocent, you know, sort of jolly chap. And he's got a whole sort of semi-profile as a jazz buff. Just like Ted Heath years ago was a kind of he was an orchestral conductor. He was the Conservative Prime Minister. So I think Kenneth Clark, everybody needs to be really asking, particularly here in the UK, and I doubt if the UK press will do it, but maybe one or two possibly will, say, where are you this weekend? Because obviously the meeting is due to happen next weekend, and it's always very easy for us to say, well, it's happening, we know where it's happening, etc., etc., but having been to these meetings, you literally never know until the Thursday morning dawns and the security is staked out around the hotel. You're never quite sure whether you've been sold a bum steer.
Well, Tony, how did you get into the Bilderberg, following the Bilderberg and understanding their significance in global power?
It started in a really simple way, actually. I was involved in an occupation of a big piece of land, actually, by the River Thames, Wandsworth Bridge, and what we were doing was trying to stop a supermarket. And we'd taken it over, we built an eco-village on the land for about 6 months. There were about something like 30, 40 people living there. And we had a great deal of support from the locals, who hated the idea of another giant supermarket there. They already had five or six. They want low-cost housing in that area. And one of the chaps had seen us on the TV, and strolled over and to me and said, well, it's all very interesting, this land stuff. Yeah, you're right. You know, it's very important. The distribution of land is, you know, is really crucial. And everybody needs to have a bit of land. There's plenty of land to go around for everyone. But he said also the money problem. And, you know, we need to look at the who has control over money and how we've got into this ridiculous habit of having a few private people, you know, issuing and controlling the money. And he said the Bilderbergers. He talked about the Bilderbergers sort of controlling the political system around Europe. And I thought to myself, hang on, this guy's crazy. But I wrote down the name. And when I got back to Oxford, where I was working at the time, I plugged it into the Reuters article database, which was just for the Reuters people, which I'd been given access to for a few weeks. And I had a friend, actually, as well, who was doing this sort of news search service. And the Bilderbergers popped up, and I thought, my goodness, these people really are powerful. And when, of course, you sit down and go through who these people are, they do actually control most of the money in the Western world. We're talking about not just the finance people, but also we've got the Secretary General of NATO there. You know, we've got kings and queens, and we've got some of the big media people, as well as the oil industry, all kinds of big industries. You know, and there's an immense amount of power sitting around that table. And this year, in Spain, I mean, you know, we had the last meeting, of course, in Greece, which has just gone through its rather horrendous financial reorganization, the IMF riots. And so one must wonder, particularly if one's living in Spain, whether the Spanish people are going to be subjected to the same kind of thing in the coming months and year. I got into studying the Bilderbergers while I was at Oxford, as I said there, and it was fantastic because I had access to the Bodleian Library, which is really one of the best libraries in the world, with books going back to the sort of 1500s, 1600s. And in the English Civil War, I was looking through a lot of stuff from the English Civil War, which, of course, was massively important in world history as really the you know, essentially the birthplace of capitalism, where the merchant classes took over England. And, you know, up until then, it had been mostly little city-states and things like that around places like Venice. And suddenly, the merchant classes had a grip. They got rid of Charles I, who actually was really quite a radical reformer of, he wanted to stop privatization of land or enclosure, Charles I, and he was beheaded for his trouble. And you saw the rolling out, you know, during that historical period of a whole kind of merchant class, with the City of London taking a grip of the politics of the country and forming laws over the last few hundred years, 350 or so, that have that enabled the Industrial Revolution here in the UK, in England actually, and then the British Empire, which of course is the biggest the world's ever seen. So, you know, that was how I got into getting to the roots of Bilderberg in the Oxford libraries, digging out the initial material from the 1950s, even actually back to the 40s, and the War and Peace Studies Group, which was part of the, I think it's the CIA or the OSS at the time, and the Council on Foreign Relations, of course. They were the people that actually put the Bilderbergers together, and I was privileged enough, really, to be able to go through their databases and their books and dig out some of the original material from the formation of it. And the thing that really sparked my interest was this whole thing about Prince Bernhard, this Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands that started the whole thing, and he was the first chairman up until 1975 from the 50s, being a Nazi. And not just any old Nazi, he'd been an enthusiastic member of the SS in the run-up to the Second World War, and then, of course, the Bilderbergers will say, oh, of course, you know, he was kind of just doing what everyone else did. But, of course, if you go into it, you'll find that Bernhard, after the Second World War, who was a director of KLM Royal Dutch Airlines, was one of the people instrumental in Project Paperclip, which was springing Nazi war criminals from the jails that were about to go to trial and actually scooting them over to South America. So Bernhard clearly was, you know, a full-blooded Nazi. And to have this guy as the main person running the Bilderbergs right from the very beginning, right up till 1975 and the Lockheed scandal, shocked me so much I thought, well, this is worth putting up on the internet and getting a website going.
I think what he said was that the he's on a Skype connection, that the CIA had funded the first few Bilderberg groups. Did you hear that, Tony?
The first meetings, yeah, I think they were. You know, this clearly was, you know, and you can, in a way, you can kind of understand that the U.S. intelligence will want very much want the Europeans to be steered across the Atlantic rather than sort of eastward to the Russian bear. And, you know, you can understand that, particularly because there's you know, nearly 3,000 miles of water between you and us here in Britain. And, you know, the obvious tendency is to really sort of make friends with the people who are your continental neighbours. But the trouble was that they chose the Nazis to do it, basically. You know, people who were still around after the Second World War. And NATO was formed, you know, the earliest meetings were formed by many of the international supporters of the SS. You know, people from Britain who were actually secretly supporting the SS were part of some of the first NATO meetings. So there's a kind of continuity between the Secretary Generals of NATO and the original Nazis, I think.
Yes, and also that could be traced to the United States, to our NASA, and also some of the first, I believe it's the National Security Council. Some very weird things happened after World War II that is definitely not in the history books, and it is very disconcerting and very. It's a big concern that this guy was a Nazi.
I just want to say one thing about the research in the United States on all this stuff. Because there's one guy, Dave Shedrow, I don't know if you've come across him, but he's put an amazing website called Roundtable together, which is all about the Council on Foreign Relations and the origins of the Milner groups, the Roundtable groups, which they came from.
Good information. You said that was Roundtable?
Yes, Roundtable's the website. I've mirrored it on my own site as a sort of subdirectory. But it's brilliant. You know, I think he's done an amazing job on that.
Great. And, of course, people can go to thesecrettruth.com and click off to your site and then launch off onto that. Yeah, there's a lot of information that's getting into the mainstream. Do you think the popular media will pick up on it this year?
Yes, I do, because particularly because all this information has been leaked beforehand, but also because The Guardian covered it last year, and I think it's, and I know Russia Today are planning to send a crew over this year. So, you know, there's definitely going to be a bit of media there sticking their cameras across the fence or in the noses of people as they come in and out. If anyone wants to hear our radio show we do here in Bristol, it's thisweek.org.uk. That's not a very common domain, I imagine, for Americans to dial up, .org.uk, because we're non-profit. But we, you know, we do a review of the news every week. Last week, for example, we did a whole thing about the tyranny of the mobile phone companies. We had an ex-Royal Navy microwave warfare engineer telling us about how dangerous these microwaves are, the microwave masts and the phones and all that kind of thing.
Well, tell me, Tony, what are your thoughts about your new conservative government and what does it all mean?
Well, there's two big Bilderbergers as part of this new government. The first is Kenneth Clark, we were talking about before. He's he's an old timer from Margaret Thatcher's government, and he rose there to be to be Chancellor of the Exchequer under Margaret Thatcher. And you know, he's one of these people who is really despised by large parts of the Conservative Party because he's so pro-Europe. He's very much pro-EU. He thinks that we really should be run from Brussels, even though he wouldn't actually put it like that. Every kind of change that there is, he wants to sort of push the country further and further towards being run from Belgium. And the other person is George Osborne. He's a bit of a different. He's the generation below Kenneth Clark, really. He's a young boy from Oxford. He was one of the members of this Bullingdon Club alongside David Cameron as the Prime Minister. So there are several. In fact, there's another guy whose name escapes me right now who was also in this Oxford Bullingdon Club. I don't know how many people in the US are familiar with it, but it's a kind of drinking club. It's not like your US fraternities quite so much, but they do have a very strong reputation for lawlessness and sort of getting away with it. You know, what they try and do is they try and sort of smash up the place where they booked for dining, and of course they pay the bill, whatever it is, the next week. And then they have a bit of fun trying to evade the law afterwards. The other thing that is rumoured anyway, and some people have actually said that they've seen this, is that the new members actually get blooded, you know, sort of actually cut with a bit of smashed glass as well. Mm. So this is the kind of culture they're from. They're kind of the thuggish toffs, not the jolly good chap types at all. Several members of the new cabinet, but George Osborne the new Chancellor of the Exchequer here. I mean, I look at him on the TV when he pops up here and I think this guy's a joke. He doesn't really seem to have the gravitas of someone who's dealing with, you know, a modern-day multi-billion-pound economy. He looks like a kind of joker, a stand-in or something, and he looks rather bemused by it all. We haven't seen hardly anything of him on the TV. And the other thing about all this is that they've had to stitch together a coalition. There's a whole kind of history, really, here, in that, really, the Conservatives under David Cameron should have managed to win a massive victory over Gordon Brown, because of the financial crisis that seemed to be sort of related to Brown, and Brown was supposed to be in charge, and it's time to have another, you know, have another, some more people. 30% the Conservatives were ahead in the polls in several months before the general election, and it slowly slid back to virtually zero. So that under David Cameron's leadership, the Conservative Party have completely failed to win the election that was should have been an open door for them. And the reason this has happened is because Cameron, of course, is actually a corporatist. He's an internationalist. He's a Euro lover of the European Union and the City of London. He's not really a traditional Conservative at all. So he's been pushing the Conservatives towards this kind of anti-Conservative view and anti-patriotic view. And as a result, he's lost loads of the Conservative votes. And what's happened is the Liberal Democrats picked up votes,
Tony,
and now they hold the balance of power.
Yeah, Tony, do you see a breakup of the European Union? And what are the Euroscepticist people like Daniel Estulin? He's been, you know, after him, and he's going to speak before the Parliament on June 1st, I believe.
I think there's a great...
What are your thoughts on the European Union?
There's a great reluctance amongst many civil servants and officials, as well as, obviously, the military and senior diplomats. There is a great reluctance to really move to control by Europe. There are a few people, internationalists and Bilderbergers, people like this, who think it's a great idea. But I think that there's a natural concern about handing power over to some sort of body which, even though most of the people don't think of it as a fascist organization or as a Nazi organization, they see it as a kind of real bureaucratic and foreign organization. So I think there's a reluctance. As regards the economics of it, I'm not an economist, so I can't talk about that. I have no idea whether the sort of crisis in will spread to Spain, and this will create. But all I can say is, I think many people here in the UK are very glad that we're not in the euro right now, and that we can still do things like the quantitative easing, as they call it, or print money in order to keep our economy going. Whereas, of course, the Greeks can't. You know, a really crucial part of all this is Bilderberg, actually, because George Papandreou, the Greek Prime Minister, he's been in the situation the last few weeks where he's had to make really big decisions about whether his loyalty is to his country, whether they can revive the drachma, whether they can start to take control of their own currency, or whether that policy is going to be dictated by people like Jean-Paul Trichet from the European Central Bank. And he has made it absolutely obvious to everybody that he's saying that, no, we have no power over this anymore. And that is where Bilderberg had to have somebody in that role to make that decision. If Papandreou had decided, no, I think what we should do is revive our own currency, take control of the Greek economy, then it would have been a whole different scenario. And actually, that probably would have wrecked the euro. As it happens, it's still just about holding together. But the Bilderbergers have got to have people in all these countries who are traitors to their own country in order for this plan to succeed. And goodness knows, you know, if the Spanish, the Portuguese, the Italians, you know, if they've got enough political clout in all those countries to make them do what the European Central Bank says against their own national interest.
Well, perhaps Bill Still, the creator of The Secret of Oz, I know he's in Europe, I think, this week and for the coming weeks, Switzerland, I'm not sure where else he was going, Germany, I think, and three different countries. Of course, you're familiar with Bill Still's work.
Oh, yeah,
Do you think that it's possible that he could actually reach some of the leadership
I don't know. I don't honestly know. I think it's just it's a question of whether the academics usually. I mean, if the academics are into this stuff. But yes, I think, you know, an activist, you know, anybody really who can talk to the right people at the right time and be prepared. I think what's happened in Britain is we have been reasonably well prepared. We can see that the idea of having Brussels running our economy is not necessarily a good one. And, of course, he who pays the piper calls the tune.
So, what nobody seems to deny is there's a bunch of famous, powerful, rich, highly trailed around people whom, when they meet up, are ignored by the press, which, if it tells us nothing else, does tell us about the ability of a small number of influential people to arrange for media blackouts. Now, this, of course, is less true in the day of the internet than it used to be. The first large audience which was reached that I'm aware of was a 2001 programme on UK Channel 4, part 5 of a series by John Ronson called The Secret Rulers of the World. Slightly tongue-in-cheek, not particularly serious, but yeah, with an edge. I'm not an expert on John Ronson, but yeah, that was the first broadcast, and that was with reporter James Tucker, who is a long-term Bilderberg watcher over 30 years. And now let's hear a recording from 2005. This is BBC World Service.
This weekend, in a luxury hotel outside Washington, D.C., Europe's secret rulers are apparently meeting their American counterparts. Or some people believe that's the case. Today is the start of the annual gathering of the Bilderberg Group. Never heard of it? Well, that's the point. It's described as a private gathering, but with a guest list including the heads of European and American corporations, political leaders, and some intellectuals. Bill Hayton has been trying to find out more.
A few miles outside Washington lies the Westfield Marriott Hotel, an exclusive place with some fine golf courses. This weekend it's fully booked. You can't get a bed or a round of golf. That's because around 120 of the world's most important people will be there for this year's meeting of the Bilderberg Group, but not according to the hotel's management.
Executive Office, Stu Damon, may I help you?
Oh, hello, my name's Bill Hayton from BBC World Service.
Yes.
Hi there. I just wanted to check, there's some kind of big event happening to your hotel this weekend. Would you be able to tell me what it is?
There's a couple weddings.
Right, but there's a big conference going on as well.
Not that I'm aware of.
Right, there's nothing being organised by the Bilderberg Group then at the hotel.
I'm sorry, who?
The Bilderberg Group.
I don't even know who they are.
Neither do most people. But last year, this obscure organisation hosted, among many others, the chairman of ABB, France Telecom, Eni and Deutsche Bank, plus several European commissioners, central bankers, newspaper editors, the Secretary General of NATO, and the Queens of Spain and the Netherlands. Plenty of people have alleged that Bilderberg, named after the Dutch hotel where it had its first meeting in 1954, is a global conspiracy. The British journalist John Ronson, whose book on the subject first brought Bilderberg into polite conversation, said it's not quite as bad as that, but interesting nonetheless.
I'm a sort of semi-conspiracy theorist when it comes to Bilderberg, because I do think that they wouldn't go to that much trouble of having this incredibly expensive international conference every year, and they'd go to all this trouble to keep themselves out of the press, and to be really secret, and to you know, spend a fortune and invite, you know, the world's most powerful people. If it was just a chat and a game of golf, which is basically what they say it is, they say they're a think tank and they play golf on the Saturday. I do think they have some impact on world affairs, but I don't think they have as much of an impact.
But given that subjects such as the future of the European Union, a possible war in Iraq, and the expansion of free trade are all on the agenda, should we not know a bit more about what's going on? I approached the Bilderberg office for a comment, but sadly no one was available. So if your boss has slipped off for a few days' golf this weekend, you might ask him or her if they've been anywhere near Chantilly, Virginia, and if they know what the future has in store. But then again, they probably wouldn't tell you anyway.
Right, kind of a jokey ending there. The whole thing is just over 3 minutes, so not a tremendous amount of effort put in to get to the bottom of that. Is the world being run from Bilderberg or not? Doesn't seem to be a particularly important issue. I'm thinking that's kind of a perfunctory piece that the BBC can say, look, we have reported on it, there is no media blackout. But the next piece I'm going to play is something that really surprises me, because this seems to provide a few leads, and this was broadcast in 2003, at a time when the Bilderberg really was not very well known about at all. Tony Gosling put up his website, which is how I found out about it, in 1999. There was the Channel 4 programme in 2001, but it really wasn't on people's radar. So why would the BBC put such an open-minded programme? I'm slightly impressed by this, but remember, this is the BBC which puts forward programmes to point out how foolish people are to question the US government's official conspiracy theory, for example, about the World Trade Center 7 collapse. Now, one theory is that times have changed and people used to have a higher degree of editorial independence, and perhaps programs like the following are a reason for why the BBC has been reined in. I'm not sure. Are we being subtly led the wrong way about the Bilderberg Group when it says things like the early meetings were shrouded in secrecy, leaving you to assume that later ones aren't? Well, we know that's not accurate. So is there more to this piece than beats the ears? If you've got thoughts, I'd love to hear them. I'm robin@altruist.org. For what it's worth, then, this is from BBC Radio 4, a UK talk radio.
Simon Cox presents Club Class.
Imagine a club where presidents, prime ministers and international bankers rub shoulders, and where royalty's on hand to make sure everyone gets along. Where the people running wars, the markets and Europe say what they never dare to in public. Welcome to the world of Bilderberg, the most exclusive and secretive club in the world.
When you're doing good, you do it in the sunshine. When you do evil, you do it in the darkness.
I, of course, am absolutely forbidden from discussing anything that has been said on any specific subject by any individual.
And every time I raise the issue of Bilderberg, I get sent from pillar to post.
I don't know how conspiracies act, actually. I think if Bilderberg were a conspiracy, I wouldn't be talking to you.
Bilderberg meets just once a year. Its cast list is a who's who of transatlantic political and corporate power. There's one important rule. No one who goes is able to say what was discussed or even who was there. For almost 50 years, Bilderberg has operated unnoticed. Even now, few people know it exists. Jim Tucker's trying to change that.
If 120 film stars or 120 football players went behind closed doors for 3 days, all newspapers would bust their butts trying to find out what happened. If 120 of the world's most powerful men, leaders in international finance, heads of state, high officials of the U.S. government, get together behind closed doors, armed guards, for 3 days, why is there no curiosity?
Jim is a veteran right-wing journalist who's been tracking Bilderberg for the last 2 decades. He's convinced that it meets in secret because it's got something to hide.
Well, when you're doing good, you do it in the sunshine. When you do evil, you do it in the darkness. For some reason, it's critical that the world not know what transpires behind those closed doors.
You really think they're evil?
Yes.
Conspiracy theorists like Jim Tucker believe Bilderberg is a shadow government secretly trying to control the world. We wanted to find out the truth. This year's Bilderberg was being held in mid-May, and we wanted to be there. The organisers had promised to tell us where it was being held, but Jim alerted us first about a hotel in Versailles.
Rien au Palais Versailles, Patricia. Bonjour, pouvez-vous vous servir?
Bonjour, réservation s'il vous plaît?
Oui.
Ça service réservation. Fabienne, bonjour.
Bonjour. I'd like to reserve a room, if possible, on the 15th and 16th of May.
I'm sorry, but the hotel is closed for these dates.
It's closed?
Yes.
Right. What, is it a conference or something? Or I've tried to book before.
Well, closed,
and it's never,
sure.
You're just closed?
Yes.
Is this the Bilderberg Conference Hotel?
No, I don't know what is the Bilderberg Conference. So.
Right. But there's no one staying there. I mean, the hotel is
no.
just going to be closed
yeah.
for the whole weekend.
Yeah.
Thank you, anyway.
You're welcome, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We weren't the only people who were interested in Bilderberg. Mainstream politicians have now begun asking tough questions about the organisation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tomorrow in Versailles, as far as I can tell, the meeting of Bilderberg will begin. Now, the reason I raise this question is there have been a number of commissioners, Commissioner Monti, Lekkonen,
the Irish Green MEP, Patricia McKenna, presses the European Parliament to find out which of the powerful European commissioners will be at this year's Bilderberg. She's worried about Europe's political elite cozying up with big business for 3 days of secret discussions.
And every time I raise the issue of Bilderberg, I get sent from pillar to post. I should have had a reply on the 25th of April. I still have not got a reply. The Bilderberg meeting is starting at the weekend.
Patricia McKenna is part of the anti-globalisation lobby, who believe the world is run for the benefit of multinational companies. She sees Bilderberg as a useful way for big business to get its own way.
The kind of Europe that they want is basically a Europe which pursues the current policy on free trade, which ignores the criticism of the anti-globalisation campaigners around the world, which has a policy that's geared towards multinational capital, the interests of the multinationals, because when you look at it, the people who are taking part in these meetings are key players in the multinational industries, and it's in their interest that the Bilderberg meetings take place.
We arrived in Paris the day that Bilderberg was due to start. We headed straight for the hotel, which we had been told was closed. Police with machine guns now patrolled the perimeter. I headed for the entrance, where smart men in black suits, sunglasses and discreet earpieces were closely checking everyone going into the hotel grounds.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm from
you
BBC.
Paper,
I've got my press card, but that's... Is this for the Bilderberg conference, is this all the...
Well, it's for the conference, yes.
Right. And is there... there's no chance that we can come in and have a look? I'm from BBC.
I know, but it's not possible you go here.
Right.
And
there's no, the whole hotel is closed off, isn't
yes,
it?
It's closed. Hotel, closed.
We join the other spectators, a handful of journalists and conspiracy theorists who were explaining to the locals what was going on.
Rockefeller, Rothschild, Wallenberg, Beatrix de Holland, Catherine Jewett, avant le GA in Avignon.
Ah, d'accord.
Par
les finances.
Wait.
D'accord.
It's very
kind of you. Merci beaucoup.
C'est très discret, discretion.
We knew the meeting would be full of bankers and the heads of multinational companies, but spotting them would be tough. There were only a few familiar faces in a fleet of modest Renault hatchbacks ferrying guests into the safety of the hotel.
Okay, here's another room. Here's another one coming. Who's in there? That looks like Ken Clark.
Hi, Ken!
Well, there's Ken Clark just arriving.
No,
he's not saying anything to us.
No.
He didn't really seem to respond when I called his name. They're checking his a bona fide delegate on the list there.
The Queen of Spain?
Is that the Queen of Spain?
The Queen of Spain, yes.
Oh, right.
Sofia.
Ah. Whew. For 50 years, Bilderberg has kept its affairs private. There are no public records, and Bilderberg's own archives are embargoed. The only information we can be sure of come from the files of the former Labour leader Hugh Gaitskill, taken during Bilderberg meetings in the 1950s.
Hello? Ah, yes, Hugh Wilford here.
In a drab London University office block, the historian Dr. Hugh Wilford shows me the archive where Gaitskill hoarded everything from the first conference in 1954 at the Bilderberg Hotel in Holland.
Yeah,
Yeah, if I could order some additional items from the Gate School papers, please. Some items from...
Inside the copious manila folders is everything from the helpful Dutch guide to windmills to Gate School's pad with detailed notes about all of the conference speakers. In his letters, Bilderberg's secrecy was laid bare for the first time.
We found this letter. What's this one?
This is from Hugh Gateskill to his friend and Labour Party colleague Dennis Healey, in which he's telling him about the conference. He describes it as a rather special kind of conference, very hand-picked, with the proceedings private, and ends by saying that he hopes that he'll be able to give Healy further details, but meanwhile, would you please treat the whole matter as absolutely confidential, say nothing about it to anybody.
So real secrecy from the very beginning.
Yes,
because you can see when you hear about the way that it's set up why people have these conspiracy theories.
Yes, now I can quite see why that is the case, and the fact that so much secrecy was insisted upon for these early meetings. And it's something, it doesn't necessarily look very good to the, you know, leader of the British Labour Party is consulting with various representatives of the secret services and American capitalists, and doing so in such a clandestine fashion. So yes, I can see why conspiracy theories have sprung up and surrounded Bilderberg.
Bilderberg was set up to strengthen the troubled Atlantic Alliance. For 3 days, Europe and America's elite could meet and iron out any differences in private. Figures from the centre-left, like Gateskill, have always been a feature at Bilderberg, because big business and the Americans wanted to get them on their side. The conference papers show exactly what was discussed within the secret confines of Bilderberg. What's striking is the degree of consensus reached by those at the meeting on contentious topics like European integration.
Here's another interesting, it's another paper from the first one. It's about the European Union. It's interesting here saying, some sort of European Union has long been a utopian dream, but the conference was agreed that it is now a necessity of our times. Only in some form of union can the free nations of Europe achieve a moral and material strength capable of meeting any threat to their freedom. So this is 50 years ago saying we must have a European Union.
Yes. But again, reflecting the fact that many of the people involved in planning Bilderberg had also played leading roles in getting the European movement going in the late 1940s and the early 50s, and the fact the Americans want it so much as well, because they want a stronger Western Europe to resist possible Soviet aggression.
Without Bilderbergers, Europe could be a very different place. From his study of the group, Mike Peters, a sociologist from Leeds Metropolitan University, is convinced that members of Bilderberg helped to conceive, create and establish all of the major European institutions.
The single currency was mooted first by people who were connected with Bilderberg. The sheer wealth and importance of the people who attend Bilderberg suggests that this is one of the most important political forums in the modern world, far more important than the G8, which seems to attract a lot of media attention. The G8 seems to be just a sort of showcase. The number of journalists and academics writing about the G8 dwarfs the number of students of Bilderberg.
It's only in the last few years that British MPs have started asking awkward questions about Bilderberg. In 1999, Tony Blair was questioned about Bilderberg by the Liberal Democrats. His written reply reveals little. "I've been told that Bilderberg usually invites a number of people from government," he said, "but there's no formal representation by the UK. What the Prime Minister fails to mention is that both he and the Chancellor were at Bilderberg when they were in opposition. The Tory MP, Nicholas Winterton, believes no one in government wants to talk about the group.
I asked, I think, two or three questions and got a totally negative reply. In my view, it's quite clear that nobody wishes to talk about Bilderberg and those that take part in their meetings.
What bothers Eurosceptics like Nicholas Winterton is the Europhile tendency of Bilderberg. He wants to know what elected European politicians are saying in their lengthy private discussions with powerful, unelected, unaccountable corporations.
I'm not saying that what they're doing is illegal. I'm saying it is somewhat sinister, and bearing in mind they're such powerful people, why are they not prepared to be more open about the subjects that they discuss and perhaps even the decisions that they reach following these discussions? Maybe if I get Kenneth Clark on one side one day, I might have a natter in his ear as to why he went, what was discussed, if he's prepared to declare to me what was discussed, and why he actually took a decision to go to such a meeting.
If you do speak to Kenneth Clark, you can ask him for us, because he won't speak to us about it. He wouldn't tell us why he'd been, why he chooses to go, why he's on the steering committee, so he's quite a key member of Bilderberg.
I shall certainly ask him that, and will indicate that I think it's very wrong that a politician is not prepared to be more open when he meets important people at clearly what is an important gathering each year.
Will you let us know what he says?
I suspect I shall get just as rough an answer as you have, and a negative answer, I don't think for a moment, sadly, that he would reveal to me what transpires at these gatherings.
Day two of the conference, and with all the guests inside, we tried to get a peek through the dense foliage of the surrounding parkland. Our guide was Chris Bolin, a photographer for Jim Tucker's right-wing magazine, who's been to almost as many Bilderberg conferences as our own Kenneth Clark.
It's quite secretive, isn't it, obviously? I mean, look, ahead of us, there's security and then a long driveway, maybe half a mile up to the hotel. I mean, we're not going to get anywhere near it.
What's important with Bilderberg is discretion. They don't want to be identified. That's why when they drive up, they hide their faces. They don't want the public to know that they're attending this meeting. A secretive about it. Why do they not want to be identified with Bilderberg?
Why do you think that is?
Because they know that what they're doing is undemocratic. They know that what they're doing is not proper.
What could they do to make you think it's okay, they're being open, there's nothing sinister going on?
Well, a tiger can't change his spots or whatever. They can't change what they are, and what they are doing is undemocratic, and so they really can't show a different face because that's what they are.
We were one step ahead of the conspiracy theorists. We'd arranged to meet Bilderberg's affable Secretary General, Martin Taylor, outside the conference, and he promised to give us a list of the participants.
Hello there. Hi, I'm Simon Cox.
I'm Martin Taylor.
Thanks for coming
Shall
out.
Should we go somewhere a little bit quieter?
Absolutely. Sure.
I brought you the papers you were looking for.
Oh, right. So
these are the same as the list of participants that will be in every participant's pack.
So you've got the Prime Minister? Prime Minister?
We've got a couple
European
of
Commissioners,
yes.
Do you have many are there many European Commissioners? I'm obviously only on this first page.
We've got a couple this year. We've got Fritz Bolkestein and Pascal Lamy coming. You'll probably find a third man and shame me.
Oh, you got James Wolfensohn there, President of the World Bank. Oh, Paul Wolfowitz.
Paul will be coming later on. He's not here today.
Right, right.
It's very good of him to come because he obviously has immense pressures on his time, but he was a member of the Steering Committee of Bilderberg for many years.
So will you be looking out for people in Britain or in Europe who you think they may be interesting people to ask to the next Bilderberg meeting? Or?
Yes. Perhaps not as hard as I should be, but I mean, people come to one's attention in all sorts of ways. I mean, sometimes you see them somewhere at a meeting and they're very bright, and sometimes you read something they've written.
So how would I get to Bilderberg?
Oh, just keep on the way you're going. I don't think there'd be any problem.
And it's useful to know who's coming. What about the agenda? What are you going to be talking about?
Since Bilderberg's raison d'etre is the transatlantic relationship, and that's been somewhat in the news. I mean, you won't be surprised that we're talking about not just Iraq, but the whole issue arising from the war.
You have this sort of, I don't know the best way to describe it, a code, I suppose, isn't it, that you don't talk about the meeting.
Just what's called in English Chatham House rules.
Right. If you break those, what happens? You just wouldn't be asked again.
You wouldn't be asked again. What isn't on, and what people know isn't on, is to say, I heard X say this at a panel. Why was very critical of so and so forth, because if people think that's going to happen, they will clearly be much more careful what they say, and then you're back in the public situation.
We knew who was there, but we still didn't know what they'd said. Getting people to breach Bilderberg's secrecy rule wouldn't be easy. Discretion could be guaranteed from a cast list, including the Governor of the Bank of England, Gordon Brown's special adviser Ed Balls, the Cabinet Minister Lord Williams, Henry Kissinger, and several Prime Ministers.
we weren't surprised when they all declined politely to be interviewed.
This is Katrine Poulsen from the Prime Minister's office in Copenhagen. You wrote a letter to the Prime Minister requesting an interview regarding the Bilderberg. The Prime Minister, thank you for your request, but I'm sorry he's not able to participate in your interview. Thank you. Bye.
The message will be erased.
Some of those we contacted sounded scared that we even knew they'd been to Bilderberg. After all, they were now part of the elite, and once you're lucky enough to make club class, you don't want to be thrown back into economy. Eventually, though, some were willing to risk their privileged status and break the Bilderberg code, as long as we
Right.
didn't name them.
Okay. Many thanks. Many thanks for your help. Bye-bye. Sure. I've just spoken to the first person who has been this year who will actually talk to us off the record and tell us some more details about what was actually discussed at Bilderberg this year. What he has told us is that one of the key aspects of this year's Bilderberg was the battle between the French and the Americans. The French Foreign Minister was there, and the Deputy Defence Secretary, Paul Wolfowitz, was there from America, and he said that he was really surprised by how hurt the Americans were. And the depth of feeling. He said their nerves were really raw, that they couldn't even talk about Iraq policy. One of the most shocking comments was from the French Foreign Minister, Dominique de Villepin, who said that if it wasn't for the French and the Pope, that the war in Iraq would have seemed like a war against Islam. De Villepin had also said that if the Americans hadn't said it was about weapons of mass destruction, but in fact it was just about regime change, that maybe the French would have supported them. And obviously they're fairly incredible comments. If they were said openly anywhere else, they would have been front page news, especially in the French press and internationally. But of course no one has heard these comments because the whole nature of Bilderberg is that it's secret. One of the other interesting things he told us was that you might expect the politicians to dominate these kind of meetings, but he said that wasn't the case, that there were some of the businessmen there who were very active in the political discussions. What he also said as well was interesting was that the regulars, people on the steering committee, people like Kenneth Clark, Henry Kissinger, they would tend to lead and tend to dominate a lot of the discussions. And what he was surprised at was the tone of just how frank generally all the discussions were. He said it was like just being in a bar or a restaurant, the kind of language and the tone of the discussions. He said it was like being around normal people. What's unique about Bilderberg is that bankers and businessmen get to share the stage with politicians. Other sources told us the financial muscle was depressed and it was the politicians who were to blame. There was a feeling of crisis, was how one source put it. Some businessmen had warned the Americans and Europeans there could be a massive recession or even a trade war unless they stopped arguing. Since Bilderberg, Europe and America has got along much better. A coincidence, according to Bilderberg, but more ammunition for their critics. Getting anyone to speak on the record about Bilderberg was proving tough. After getting the OK from the organisation, the Financial Times economics commentator Martin Wolf agreed to be interviewed, but with certain conditions.
I, of course, am absolutely forbidden from discussing anything that has been said on any specific subject by any individual participant. If you're happy to interview me on that basis, I'm happy to go ahead with the interview, provided we can find a suitable time. Bye.
There'd been a virtual news blackout at this year's conference, in spite of the fact there were journalists present from the New York Times, Newsweek and The Economist, to name but a few. But Martin Wolf, who's a Bilderberg regular, doesn't feel compromised that he can come to such a high-powered meeting, but he can't report what was discussed.
The underlying aim was to make it possible for people who are making top-level decisions and interpreting the world on the two sides of the Atlantic really to understand how other people were actually thinking, as opposed to what they were at that point prepared to tell the press. So the logic is, which is, to me, it's always been persuasive. I've always believed that it is obvious there are things people are prepared to say, particularly people in power, are prepared to say privately that they cannot say publicly, that it is very important for the people who deal with them to understand how they're thinking, what's the background to what they're doing, rather than just what they're saying for public opinion.
The people we had spoke to who were at the meeting were talking about the very differing opinions of Dominic de Villepin, the French foreign minister, and Paul Wolfowitz on Iraq, and you know, a discussion which, if it was in a public forum, certainly in France and probably elsewhere, would have been front page news.
Certainly can't confirm that, because that was part of the discussion. You know that they were both participants, and you know from their well-known and published opinions that they disagree on quite a large number of matters. So I think the inference you're drawing wouldn't seem an unreasonable inference to draw. Perhaps at the end of it, both of them understood, all the people involved will have understood better what the other actually thinks.
What unites Bilderberg's critics is concern over top corporate figures being allowed such unfettered access to senior politicians with no public scrutiny. Back at his day job as chairman of W. H. Smith, I get the opportunity to once again question Martin Taylor. How does he persuade powerful bankers and businessmen to give up their time if they don't have anything to gain?
I've never needed to sell it to anybody, is all I can say. The only reason I've ever heard somebody say that they didn't want to come was that they couldn't on the dates concerned. I mean, people are attracted, I think, by sheer curiosity at being in a group like this and hearing certain things from the horse's mouth, as it were. And I think that the personal relations that are formed there, not in the sense of some ghastly Freemasonry the sort of secret society, not that at all, but it's just the fact that people have a chance to get to each other as individuals rather than as people that they come across in their government or business careers.
Which they don't. I suppose it's not, because what I think the nub of people's worries is not really that you put a lot of politicians together and they have discussions. I mean, they do
that all
the
time, yes.
But it's when you have senior business figures with politicians in an unaccountable setting, that's what really worries people.
But does anybody among your highly educated and sensitive group of listeners suppose for a moment that these people don't meet all the time anyway?
Well, presumably they don't, otherwise why would Bilderberg exist?
Well, of course they meet all the time, but they meet on an individual basis rather than, you know, 120 in a room together. Do you really think that senior business people don't talk to politicians? I mean, it doesn't happen as much actually in Britain as in other countries. If you talk to senior politicians in Germany, for example, senior business people, they're talking twice a week.
Politicians and businessmen may meet regularly, but what's unique about Bilderberg is the calibre of the corporate and political figures gathered together in one place, and most importantly, in private. So are they, as their critics believe, trying to reach collective decisions about issues like Europe?
I mean, there's no such thing as Bilderberg thinking. I mean, we have people from both sides of the political debate. If you take the two steering committee members from the UK, myself and Ken Clark, I mean, we have diametrically different views on the desirability of British participation in the euro, for example. You know, generally speaking, there are more people at the Bilderberg conferences who would be in UK terms, you know, highly Europhile, but that isn't surprising because the elites on the continent are 90% highly Europhile. And I've had some correspondence with people arguing that Bilderberg was actually a machine for getting rid of national sovereignty in the UK. All I can say is I've never seen it.
So a comment I saw that said that if Bilderberg isn't a conspiracy, it certainly acts like one. Do you think that's an unfair assumption?
Well, I think it's absurd. I don't know. I mean, you know, who's editing? I mean, you've given me a statement taken out of context with which I can't possibly agree. I don't really know how conspiracies act, actually. I think if Bilderberg were a conspiracy, I wouldn't be talking to you this morning.
Martin Taylor may portray Bilderberg as little more than a high-powered talking shop, but to his critics, it will always be an exclusive and secretive club with too much power. Until Bilderberg does the impossible and opens up, that will always be the suspicion. It may not be a global government, but for the world's elite,
the discussions they have and the people they meet at Bilderberg must influence the way they run their businesses, their economies and their countries.